complexity is the enemy of profits in the real estate development business. That the more complex project that you take on, the more complex market that you take on, the more complex construction methodologies, entitlement complexity, and land acquisition, all those add friction to the process, which both slows down your development cycle, but also increases the likelihood for mistakes to show up or breakdowns to be caused. And you can never eliminate all the friction. You can't reduce, you know, like I use the term simplify, but not simple, right? Development will never be simple in the way that, you know, we know.
Welcome to the CRE Project Podcast, where investors, developers, brokers, and real estate entrepreneurs join together to grow, build, and execute on experience and strategies within the commercial real estate industry. We sit down with the top pros and leaders within the commercial real estate field and gain knowledge and insight from their success. We're glad you're here and look forward to connecting with you. You can find the CRE Project on all major podcast platforms, along with YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. Hey guys, welcome to the CRE Project Podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Clayton here. On today's show, we welcome a gentleman by the name of Scott Chopin. Scott is with Urban Pacific, which is a workforce housing developer out of California, and they've been in business for nearly 50 years now. And this conversation was just really enlightening, really interesting. We talk about an asset class that is very underdeveloped, and there's huge opportunity in, and Scott is making things happen in a very challenging market. So we learn about his lessons learned over the years when it comes to workforce housing and what he's kind of predicting for future development in that specific asset class. So we just thought it was a very informative show. We loved it. We know you will too. Here we go.
Hello, CRE Project Podcast listeners. Thanks again for joining in. We've got Scott Chopin on the show today with Urban Pacific. He is a affordable multifamily housing developer. And Scott, thank you for spending some time with us on the show today.
Yeah, great to be here with you guys. Looking forward to the conversation.
You know, as we were talking offline just a little bit, Clayton and I specialize for the most part in retail leasing and development. And so getting into this particular asset class and arena is new for us. We haven't really had, have we had any multifamily developers, Clay, at this point, right?
No.
Scott's our first?
Yeah, no, we were, it was funny because we were laughing at how kind of refreshing it is to talk about a new type of
something,
asset.
Something a little bit different. Yeah.
Yeah. We're excited about this. So absolutely.
Okay, guys. I'm happy to be the guinea pig, guys.
Well, thank you. Thank you, man. I mean, we did our research and I mean, you know, your accolades speak for themselves. It looks like you have grown up in this industry. You're in a thriving market. So I don't know if that was strategic or luck or a little bit of both, but you know,
Mostly strategic, but we can get into that as we talk about it. Happy to give details there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the first question I'd like to lead off with as we're opening up for our listeners is, you know, the terms affordable housing, workforce housing, market rate housing, you know, they're tossed around a lot in conversation. Mm. Can you just put some color on that for our listeners, kind of the differences and where you fit into that segment?
Absolutely. And it's a great question. In fact, I find myself regularly defining what workforce housing means. So we have, you know, everybody has a common, you know, thread to think from. So the way I think of it is, you know, what I call true affordable, and people who are in the affordable housing industry don't call it that, would be, you know, housing that's generally government subsidized in some way, and generally will serve families or seniors at or below 60% of the median income wherever that project is located. So, you know, you guys are in, you know, Albuquerque. So Albuquerque MSA would have, you know, published rents. Workforce, you know, roughly would be above 60%, about to 120% of median income although we regularly speak more along lines of 80 to 120 median income. So for our projects in Southern California, LA and Orange counties, where we're operational right now, you know, you look at 80 to 120 of LA and Orange County median incomes. And then roughly market rate would be 120 and above. Now I say roughly because in some markets, so if you took like the New York market, right, you know, Manhattan and the five boroughs, they'll actually include workforce, sometimes called moderate income, up to 150% of median income because housing prices are so high in that particular market. And it'd be true also for places like SoCal and the Bay Area, that they have to sort of raise the bar of what is moderate. It's actually higher incomes just to, you know, fit into the moderate income category. And then I'll just qualify a little bit. So we really, we're not an affordable housing developer in the sense that most people would think of.
Okay.
We really are a market rate developer that happens to specialize in the workforce housing, you know, sector is the way I would put it. It is, people might define it as a type of affordable housing. Sometimes we call it moderate, workforce, attainable, right? It has all these different definitions. But for us, really, the way we think of our model, which we call urban townhouse or UTH, is we're really pairing private capital with a workforce housing rental model. And why I say it that way is because we don't use government subsidy, but we also don't have a restriction or a covenant to rent restrict the way a normal, you know, what I describe as true affordable housing would be. Now, we do structure our deals such that the rents do fit into those income categories that I described, 80 to 120, like I said earlier. But we're sort of, that's part of our innovation and, you know, sort of ongoing evolution of the product type, you know, UTH that we build exclusively now, by the way. Is to really come up with using private capital in a new way, such that we can build and deliver, own, develop housing units that serve families in these income categories, but not requiring any other special, you know, financing, you know, money from the government or that kind of thing, which makes it really completely uncommon and unique, and really the thing we're most excited about because it's a solution that uses generally, I don't want to say infinite capital in the market rate side, but it is certainly for deals that produce good yields. You usually can, in a normal market, raise capital, you know, on a fairly unlimited basis, where in true affordable housing, government subsidy only goes so far. It's finite, is the way I say it. And so they build up to using that finite source of government subsidy, and then there's no more to be produced. So our model sort of pairs the, you know, the attainability and the affordability, or at least moderate workforce housing model, with this, you know, larger source of, you know, private equity in the deals.
Perfect. Well, thank you for the clarification, because we were curious as to if it was more of a public-private partnership, or if it was just private capital that you lever with traditional bank financing, and or how you guys are actually structuring those deals.
It is very standard. I would say, I'll just caveat, we do on occasion add an inclusionary requirement. So we may actually restrict it at or below 60 or 50 or 40% of median income, making it true, but we'll do, you know, 5% or 10% of the rents, and we'll make that move to facilitate, let's say the development standards are too restrictive in city A or B. We'll say in California, we can give them that 10%, and then they'll give us a waiver on the development standards. So it's a way to maybe increase density, or at least lessen parking requirements or setbacks, that kind of thing. So we're always sort of dancing with, you know, as you guys know, in your own business, every deal is different, different city, different, you know, parameters, different micro market. We're just looking to be, you know, as any developer is, you know, most effective and produce yields for our investors and ourselves.
That's phenomenal. And there's absolutely a demand for it. I mean, especially in markets such as Los Angeles and Long Beach and Orange County and all the major metros. I mean, anybody who has followed the housing market or commercial real estate in general knows there's a housing shortage. And so, I mean, I'm sure that cities and municipalities and equity partners are excited about the opportunity to work with you, especially now that you've been doing this for a period of time and have proof of concept. And like you said, there's so much dry powder on the sidelines right now looking for yield, especially strong operators and syndicators. So with that being said, With all the different asset classes, what was it about this particular niche that motivated you to focus in this arena?
Yeah, great question. Appreciate that. So, you know, if I just look back, I won't go through my entire history, but, you know, for the most part, well, two important things that really sort of, you know, informed my choice of, you know, generally career as an entrepreneur in real estate, being a real estate developer. I basically, my first job was with a company at the time that was known as Kaufman & Broad. It's now KB Home, you know, national home builder. And I worked there for subsidiary
yeah, sure.
Run by a guy named Mike Costa. And that group was called Kaufman & Broad Multi-Housing Group. And specifically, we were a developer. This division was a developer and syndicator of true affordable, the way we talked about before, using government subsidy. And that really taught me several things, but importantly is it really sort of launched me into my multifamily development career. I mean, I come from a family background in the real estate development business. So my dad was an apartment developer and my uncle Mike was a commercial and apartment developer. So I grew up around it, but as you guys know, you know, when you're a kid, sometimes you don't want to do what your parents did. And for a period of time, that was me. But ultimately I got to be 18 or 19 years old, it finally dawned on me, I read a couple key real estate, sort of deal making books. And I was like, oh, this is what they're doing. You know, I understood sort of the entrepreneurial part of it and had always envisioned that I would form my own company and build my career that way. Working for Mike, though, we did all affordable housing and all over the United States, although I was mostly in the senior project manager position from West Coast as far east as Denver. And that really taught me about families, and that became a key component. Really, UTH serves moderate income families. You know, we're not senior housing. We're not even housing necessarily for singles or couples. You know, we're looking to serve families that are between, let's say, 4 and 10 people. And we do that specifically by building the UTH model as a 5-bedroom, 4-bath, 3-story townhouse.
Wow, so that's phenomenal.
It's very unusual. 2-car garage on the ground floor, townhouse. So it lives like a house, you know, front door that goes out to the, you know, to the neighborhood, a garage. You know, I mean, how many apartments have their own garages? That's pretty neat by itself.
So are these condominiumized?
They're not. And I don't mean to be, you know, sort of sassy with the answer, but we're in California. And as you guys probably have heard, California has the most radical construction defect laws in the United States. And so anything that has an HOA or a condo plan or any sort of subdivision, you know, that particularly of attached product is subject to legal attack, you know, before the 10-year statute of limitations runs. But we're really dyed in the wool apartment guys. I don't even like, I mean, we've done condo projects in the past. You know, we've always focused on the urban environment, right? Like in infill neighborhoods, not suburban, but sort of in between, you know, central city and true suburban. I don't even know what to call that. You know, I've got to figure out a name for that. But, you know, these are older neighborhoods that are predominantly developed, you know, maybe older commercial housing apartments. And that's always been the environment that we played. And we've gone into central business districts. You know, we've done projects in downtown Light, downtown Long Beach, that kind of thing. But this sort of in between, you know, sort of suburban on steroids was always interesting to us because we doing infill, we could find underutilized assets or vacant parcels, and we could, you know, build housing into an already existing fabric. And so demand for housing in those environments was never really an issue, right? You always had either working folks or people who were, you know, coming first time into their careers, you know, that'd be Gen Z and millennial, you know, today's demographic. And so that from the day of starting the company in 2000, we've always been an urban infill developer, done different product types, but we're really apartment guys. So let me stop there. I'm going off the rails a little bit here.
Hey, no, that's great. And I just got one more question, and then maybe I can hand it over to Clayton to talk about KPIs and financial metrics and stuff like that. But so are you guys long-term hold developers? Do you sell these properties?
So that's a great question. So traditionally over, you know, now we're in our 20th year of operations, you know, we've sold, you know, we're just always been merchant build oriented, meaning build it, rent it, sell it. Right. And obviously when we did a handful of condo projects, of course those sold.
Yeah.
But 3.5 years ago, we completely sold out of all of our, you know, development pipeline that was non-UTH projects. So, you know, we had deals in Denver and LA and Long Beach. We'd sold everything. And basically to, you know, to fully and exclusively focus on this workforce housing model. And in the beginning years of that model, we were merchant build also. But I will tell you over about probably 18 months, give or take, depending on, you know, I go back maybe 18, 19 months, two things happened. One is we knew at that point in time that we were really long in this economic expansion. You know, I think in the beginning, late 2019, early 2020, it was the longest expansion in U.S. history, right?
Yeah.
But you know, several months before that, it was already starting to be, hey, we're coming up on that longest expansion. And then a couple other key things changed. You know, the yield curve went negative. But even before that, we were just like, we're like late. We're long in the tooth in this economic expansion. So what we made the move was to convert everything to long-term hold. That's, I'm getting to your answer here.
Yeah, sure.
And our logic was this. We have our families that rent in our units are generally working class multi-earner households. And that's a real key component of their cultural makeup, lifestyle makeup, demographic makeup, because that means when a recession comes, they are generally relatively stable in comparison because they have multiple earners in the household versus, you know, today, if you have a Gen Z or millennial renter that's, you know, renting their own apartment, if they have a change in their employment status and they have one income, then that is a game changer for their capability to, you know, continue to rent the unit. And our logic was, you know, while everybody will be somewhat destabilized in a recession, these multi-year households will be recession resilient is the terminology we came up with, that they do what we call economic sharing. So they'll share incomes and expenses across the family group. And they already live this way, right? We're just serving them with a new housing type, you know, that didn't exist heretofore. And that's turning out to be true. And before the recession, it was an affordability situation, right? High housing costs, incomes are stagnant. Multi-earner households can afford better housing. And then a recession, they're able to remain stable and resilient, which is exactly what we're seeing right now. And so we said, if those families are recession resilient and we're in a long-term hold structure for our ownership, then, and a recession comes, then in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years when the recession is at its peak or, you know, at the lowest trough, call it in this case, then we don't have to sell. We're not in any hurry to divest of the asset and get, you know, the money back to the investors. We raised money on a 10-year hold. And that basically, so we said, we're going to convert everything to long-term hold as a defensive mechanism against the recession is the short way to say it. The other component, guys, is we're after doing what we call the demonstration phase, which was the first of 4 projects in this model that we needed a proof of concept, as you described before. We're like, man, this is the best housing we've ever built. It's recession resilient, undersupplied, even today, even right in the middle of, you know, August of 2020, you know, yep. During the middle of the coronavirus era, we're actually leasing is solid. Rental rates are above pro forma. These families are turning out to be truly resilient as we anticipated. And so we're actually seeing an acceleration in our business plan. And so we just like, we're such fans of the families and the stability of this demographic and ownership of, you know, producing assets. We're like, we're going all in, we're going to own everything that we build. You know, who knows, occasionally maybe there's a deal that's, you know, good to sell. I mean, we're always, you know, like look at it both ways and balance it. But at the end of the day, our goal right now is as a 5,000 unit portfolio made up of, you know, entirely of this workforce housing model, UTH.
It's a great concept, especially when you look at these other cities, even like developers in LA or Denver, where they're doing these 300 square foot micro units. You don't get a parking spot. It's all commutable walking. And then you guys went the other direction on the pendulum and you're delivering something that I think is going to spread like wildfire. I'm sure there are other developers in other markets that are catching on for, you
know, it's 3 years ago, guys, it was like people looked at us like five veterans and four pass, like that's insane, dude. Like, you know, and it was really polarized. Some people absolutely got it. They go, oh yeah, I see that. Like, you know, didn't think about it before, but now that you tell me about it, give me the description of it, I see it, you know, particularly people in major urban metros with high housing costs, right? Like that's, you go, oh, okay. And then there's the other side of the, you know, the coin, which is people are like, I just don't understand that. And actually a lot of my institutional equity sources were like in that camp, you know, guys sitting in New York going, it's just five bedroom, four bath. That's like so far, you know, on the end of the spectrum of housing type. And I get it. It's fair. I mean, we went into it knowing that to be the case, but that's the unique part about it, is it's so differentiated that we basically immediately move into really in the, one of the lowest competitive environments for supply competition that exists in any of the, you know, housing types that you could build. And I think it will continue to be that way. Like the Trammell Crows and the Holland Partners of the world are never going to build a predominance of five bedrooms. Maybe they go, you know, I've seen, Carmel Partners or one of the REITs did some townhouse, you know, four bedroom type product, but it would be like, you know, 5% of the entire bigger institutional, you know, style apartment project. So I always make the joke that, you know, Trammell Crow is not going to land next to us with 300 units of five bedroom product, you know, anytime soon. That's fine by us. We, you know, earlier you said, I don't know if this was strategic or luck. This is exactly what we said. We go, let's be in a place that we don't expect people, that they aren't there now competitively, and we don't think they'll go there in any big way. Now, having said all that, I'll share there's a ULI and RCLCO report basically talking about family renter housing. So if you just look up ULI, RCLCO, and family renter housing, great study. And they basically are saying that in the next, I think, 5 years or something like 8 million millennial households that are going to move into the family housing part of their life cycle and need now housing that's family centric that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And this is just another one of the sort of confirmation points of what we've been talking about for 3 years. And I, you know, not pat myself on the back. I mean, we knew we had a good idea. But it's always, of course, you know, when ULI writes a report about it, it's good. But they'll also, you know, competitors will get on board. But they actually, in the report, they had several types of renter housing, you know, single family detached. In fact, they didn't even describe, you know, townhouse. Well, I guess they did townhouse attached, which is what I describe our product. But they had many different versions of family renter housing, but that their whole, the gist of their argument was, this is a huge growth area. And they were just focused on the millennials, by the way, guys. Yeah. This doesn't even anticipate Gen Z and then continuing, you know, people who might live in this environment in Gen X and baby boomer. And I say it that way because one key characteristic of these families is they always live multi-generationally.
Yeah, lots of multi-generational housing here in Albuquerque throughout New Mexico. But the concept we have here are just building little casitas in the back.
Right.
So grandma can go live back. Yeah. So it's like
a horizontal multi-generational, you know, in other words, a separate unit in the back or above the garage, like an accessory dwelling unit.
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah. And there's always going to be different versions. I mean, I'm speaking this, everybody goes, of course, ours is really a solution that was sort of created out of the crucible of the California urban marketplace where land costs are high. Hence why we do attach to increase the density to offset land cost. You know, we try to build very, very simply as we can in California, which is complicated versus everybody everywhere else. But it works. You know, now you look at Phoenix, they do the detached single family, right? Like standalone house that rents Christopher Todd Communities. Todd Communities. They do a true, like almost like a subdivision of rental homes. That's a different version of what we do. So I think we can just, at least according to ULI and RCLCO, this is like a huge growth area and also a place that there's almost, you know, no competition of any, certainly of any scale.
So I would like to take a step back really quick, Scott, not necessarily take a step back, but I'd really like to hear from you, and you spoke to it a little bit, but what, for a lot of people that may be in their mid-career or, you know, in commercial real estate and have been developing maybe in a certain asset class, or a lot of people getting into the real estate industry, why should they entertain, and what is attractive about going into development of workforce housing? And then that's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question, we've heard a lot of the good part about workforce housing. What are the headwinds that you run into? I mean, what's the difficult part about workforce housing when it comes to development?
When you say when it comes to development, meaning like any specific part of it, you know, financing versus construction, I mean, you probably mean it all, I suppose. Like what are the
neighborhood associations, maybe?
Entitlement issues. I mean, government pushback. I mean, what do you typically run into?
Well, let me answer the second question first, and then if I forget the first question, remind me. So, I mean, you know, I think for anybody, like you guys know this, anybody who is in the development domain, whether it be commercial or residential, industrial, like they'll get what I'm talking about. There's just complexity in that environment versus, you know, regular, if you're a value add investor who, you know, buys and upgrades value add multifamily assets, and then you want to move to development because you're returns are being eroded in value add. And I speak it that way because that's a common story, even in today's environment, right? And so there's just the development complexity. And I don't think that's just true for workforce housing. I think entitlements, you know, zoning are incredibly difficult and also sort of obscure, right? Like this is one of the places I see investors who move from value add into development is the, you know, the whole zoning and entitlement process is, you know, zoning's not a, like, you know, you don't learn about that in school, right? most people probably don't even tune into city council hearings or planning commission hearings. And if they did, it probably would be, you know, foreign language to them anyways. So I think that's one of the big differentiators between, you know, just regular investment and development. And you guys, you know this as I say that. As far as workforce housing particularly, I think some of the things I've mentioned were, you know, our product particularly. So, you know, workforce housing could be a broad cross section of types, right? Ours happens to be one, you know, five bedroom townhouse, right? It's just like one version of it, if you will. One is I think that just the perception by the investment community of it being non-mainstream. Right. Like if a lot of investors will go, well, what, you know, what's the predominance of the product? And I'm probably oversimplifying how people would look at it. But, you know, some people don't want to necessarily be on that far end of the spectrum of investment possibilities. And you go, wow, this thing's, you know, this is sort of non-mainstream. So I think there's that factor. You know, one of the things we get interesting pushback is when we, particularly for our product, five bedroom, four bath, some cities, planning departments and city managers, they look at the product and they go, my God, five bedrooms. That's crazy. You're going to have like, you know, 18 cars, you know, parked around this. And I usually, you know, I try to be as like non, you know, sort of confrontational about it. But usually my answer is in a normal suburban environment with, you know, higher income, you know, family, higher income families, you would probably have that, right? Like your standard suburban model where, you know, Johnny turns 16, he gets a car, right? These families are not that. And I don't mean to be like negative about the families. They're just, they're working class. You know, they have, you know, multiple earner, you know, multi-earner household, but they're usually very, I don't know what the terminology, you know, they're usually not putting their money towards that third car. Right. They really look at what do we have to do to you know, take care of our family in the most, you know, fundamental salt of the earth way, and buying a third and a fourth car doesn't fit in that narrative. Right. So they're going to put money towards, you know, maintaining the cars that we do have. And so there's some interesting factors, you know, our families don't commute long distances. In fact, the average time to job is 10 to 20 minutes. So these families are choosing to locate housing close to their job. Now, of course, we as a developer want to try to get to as many good, you know, neighborhoods that are close to job centers as possible with our housing products so we can serve those families. So that's one of them. You know, I think generally, I think, you know, mainstream thinking, you know, search setting on my Google News Reader that, you know, workforce housing, and there's
you froze up just a little bit. Can you repeat that last thought just a little bit?
Oh yeah, I was just saying that, you know, that workforce housing is more commonly discussed in mainstream media and discussion than it's ever been. Right. Yep. Like the idea of workforce housing, I think for most people, like just even just regular folks, they understand when people say workforce housing, they go, oh yeah, I understand what that is. And I mean, they may have their own definition of it, right? But you know, it's their kids or it's their in-laws or it's their grandparents that are struggling to afford housing. And so the idea of, you know, of serving families that are otherwise rent burden, meaning they pay more than the 30% of their income, like is a common discussion topic for, I think, everybody. It's certainly all major urban metros. Like you guys even, you know, described it in the beginning, all major urban metros have this issue. There's not a single large MSA in the United States that doesn't have this issue. Now it's at different levels, you know, Denver's different than Albuquerque, is different than LA, that's different than the Bay Area. But, you know, we've looked at all the major West Coast cities, you know, up to as far north as Seattle and looked at Denver. And, you know, there's a story for, you know, a middle income or workforce housing rental model in every major MSA along the West Coast and Denver. Like we've underwritten deals. I mean, we're not active in those markets except SoCal. But you know, the story is there and the metrics work. We've even looked at places like Texas. You know, I think the model would be different than what we do in California, but you know, there's a middle class, you know, multi-earner family, you know, demographic in every major city, and they're generally rent burden, meaning they pay more than 30%, and that happens everywhere in the United States.
Go ahead.
On that, are you guys looking at other markets right now, or are you just going to stay hyper focused on your backyard?
So, you know, because the product was so, you know, exploratory, you know, innovative and new and uncommon, and you know, like we really wanted to keep the geographic, you know, like location super tight, like, you know, it's close to our backyard. Like, hey, if we're going to do an experimental product, I don't want to be flying to Denver, have team members flying to Denver to manage that. It's like, you know, cities we know, construction teams that we know, you know, we don't do all our sites we buy are already zoned. So we don't deal with entitlements at all, just as a risk mitigator.
And I mean, it sounds like you guys are doing a ton of research. I mean, if you know how long the average commute time is to people's place of employment, I mean, you guys are dialed in.
Yeah, and the demonstration phase, really the purpose of that was to produce that, you know, that information. You know, in other words, we could do our basic research like any developer would, like you guys do, right? You know, what are the rents? You know, what are the operating expenses? You know, what's land cost? What's build cost? But when you go and take all that, you know, that mainstream data, and then you plug it into a really different housing type, you know, you gotta really be very judicious in the risk that you take. So we started real small. We did 4 projects, and the purpose was to do 3 things. One is we wanted to prove the rents were real. You know, we have big units. We have big rents, whole dollar rents, low per square foot because the units are so big. And we wanted to prove that, right? Nobody's doing 5-bedroom, 4-bath, at least at scale. There's a couple people doing small stuff in Los Angeles. Second one was we needed to know that we could build it for what we had in our pro forma, right? I mean, the build type is a 3-story on-grade townhouse, stick built, really standard. In fact, it's the most simple product I've ever built, you know, as a developer in our construction teams on purpose, like simple, or as simple as it can be, right? And then third was, you know, most importantly, can we sell or refi at the values that we indicated in our model, right? Can we produce the yield? And I really said, look, we got to do these early projects that, like, if it totally blows apart, like, we're going to be fine. Like, the first deal we did, we bought the land really inexpensively. In fact, that was really sort of where the idea, the seed of UTH came from. Literally bought it so cheap, guys, that I probably could have, you know, cut our rents by 30 or 40% and it still would have made sense. And that was like, I go, that's what I want, right? If we're going to be pioneering, let's not, you know, cut our left foot off. And when we get there, you go, oh gosh, we wish we hadn't done that. And that comes from, you know, as you guys, you know, have experienced, you know, everybody who's, you know, been in their career for a while, went through 2008, learned a lot of lessons, learned a lot of things of what to do, what not to do. And so we took a lot of lessons from 20 years of operations plus 2008 and really watching the rental market perform in SoCal. Rental market did relatively well, stayed very stable in SoCal. And that was really as I started to think about it, I go, what can we do that's multifamily, that's differentiated, that's uncommon, and sort of have all these pieces come together in a particular product type. So when I talked about being strategic, I was really trying to pick a product category or part of the market segment that was undersupplied and had good demand characteristics, and you know, was, you know, we could simplify the execution of it. I feel fortunate that we sort of like found the idea of UTH, but it came from a lot of work to like sort of get it into a place. And you know, mind you, you know, 3-4 years ago, doing, you know, high density podium product was the rage. I mean, everybody was doing it. And in fact, that was partly what informed us. You know, we go, oh, everybody's doing it, so it's time for us to not be.
Yeah. when they zig, you zag, right?
Right. Mm. Right, exactly.
So I got a question. Is there like an idea, not necessarily a market demographic, because like you kind of alluded to, you know, it sounds like workforce housing kind of translates throughout the entire nation. I'm curious, you know, we always hear, and this could just be our perception, but California, obviously, you know, from a value standpoint in real estate is very high.
So yeah, very renter friendly, yeah, too. You know, some investors don't even want to touch it.
Yeah. I mean, how do you make, you know, especially with not getting subsidies, you know, how do you make that work on your pro forma? I mean, yeah, is that strictly just in your land basis, or how do you make that work? I'm curious.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually no one thing by itself. It's several things combined together. And some of the stuff I've talked about, so I'll shorten it up if I've already alluded to it. So one of it is that we only buy zone land, right? So that expedites the timeline of from acquisition to delivery and rental, right? We build a simpler product. And I say simpler because it's California. It's never simple. Even a 3-story on grade, you know, they got all kinds of crazy energy requirements. And, you know, we're mandated to do solar this year. But we really simplify it vastly, right? We try to strip out, and we're always working on stripping out every little friction point. I call it friction. Anything that slows you down or could stop you, if it's enough friction, we're trying to, you know, eliminate that. Same specs over and over, same vendor team, you know, architects, civil engineers, subcontractors, and we're always, you know, adjusting, you know, the networks of people that work with us. But the other main one is that we're producing very high whole dollar rents. So our rents, you know, right now, let's say it's anywhere between $3,500 and $3,800 per unit per month of rent.
So is that like a dollar a square foot, just to give our guys a reference, or $1.20?
It ends up, so our units are $1,750. So you can do the rough math. That's around $2 a foot, maybe $180 to $210, right? But that's in a marketplace. Remember in SoCal, where rents are easily $3, $3.50, $4 a foot. Right. And of course, no renter rents on $4 a foot. They don't look at it that way. They're looking at the whole dollar rent. Right. But the key is the bedroom count and the bathroom count. Right. Having 4 bathrooms is a real key advantage. And this multi-earner household idea and this economic sharing idea. Right. Where people look at this and they go, oh, I have, you know, 4 or 5 wage earners in the household, we already share, right, incomes and expenses. And in fact, we've had family groups that were in 2 apartment units, either side by side, or maybe, you know, one was in this building and somebody else lived a block away. But as a family unit, as an economic unit, they were already sharing, right? And so, if you know, so that helps them afford, you know, more housing, right? And all we're doing is we're giving them a single unit to work with them. But I think the answer here is that we're high whole dollar rents, but we're the predominance of our space is the most affordable to build, which is bedrooms and hallways, right? And we have 5 bedrooms, big unit, 1 kitchen, right? We have 4 bathrooms, so there's some costs there. So the ratio of the cost to build it and the incomes it produces is right what we consider to be at an equilibrium point, at least for California, and you can say that for SoCal, maybe more specifically, that's at the perfect, like we can maximize density at the lowest cost, right? That's why we do 3-story townhomes and not like 4-story townhomes. That would increase the cost at the maximum ability to generate income. Now, of course, we want these to fit in the 80 to 120 category. So we always have to, you know, we're always sort of balancing these things. But at least for now, and we're not saying it will never change, but at least with construction costs, land costs, the rent we produce, the operating expenses that we have, that it produces very good yields. And then the last part I'll answer is that, you know, generally we're delivering the valuation. So we sold our last deal in January of 2020 in Long Beach. That sold for $500,000 a door, right? That was the valuation, right? And, but interestingly enough, it on a per square foot basis of sale, we were right in the market. And I can't remember the stat, but, you know, basically if you took the comps that had sold around us, old product, new product, whatever, like just take everything in a comparable, you know, surrounding the property, we fit really in the middle of the road on per square foot valuations. And then initially enough, what happens on the cap rate, which, you know, most people are buying on cap rate, right? When they buy apartments, we're actually selling at 500K a door at something like 5.5 to 6 cap. So in essence, the buyer of that property is buying at a discount to the market. When the market's at 4 cap and somebody's buying at a 6 cap, you know, that they would normally like to do that on a value add deal and raise the rents and produce value. So now we're not selling anymore. Now this shows up in appraisals. And you know, we're sitting here now today. So we're actually accelerating our business plan because land costs are dropping, construction costs are dropping, labor is more available, at least in our, you know, part of LA and Orange County. But we're starting to be more careful about underwriting. So, you know, we're not going to underwrite to 500K a door. We'll probably drop that, you know, I don't know, 25,000 a door, sort of the number I'm thinking about today as I work with our underwriting team. Just to be cautious, right? Like anticipate, you know, potential consequences. I mean, there's been no drop in values, at least that, you know, people will listen to this and go, oh, well, in my market, it is dropping. Possibly, probably. But we haven't seen, we're seeing a little bit of reduction in rents. In fact, I was just looking at Zillow, does some good research on rent levels, although they're predominantly, you know, talk about for sale. In LA, you know, we're looking at, you know, year over year, we're actually from June to June, June 2019, June 2020, we're actually up like, you know, 1.2% in LA. Differentiate a little bit right now what's happening is suburban and urban rents are being affected differently by coronavirus, right? Urban's having more rent loss. Which, you know, sort of evidences some, you know, movement from the urban environment to suburban and the apartment markets. I mean, very specific. So hopefully that answers the question. Really long answer.
Really quick, Scott, you mentioned it a couple of times and actually it relates to what you just said. You've used the term, and this again, me being totally green, but you use, you know, I think you referenced whole dollar rents, correct? What's the importance in that? And how do you respond when, you know, the market does correct? I mean, how do you kind of keep that model? Can you explain that a little bit? Because I know nothing about that.
Yeah. So whole dollar rents, I mean, I don't know that I coined the term. Maybe I heard somebody say it. It's just a way to differentiate between per square foot rents, right? Yeah. So everybody you talk to who's a professional multifamily sponsor, developer, owner, investor, thinks about per square foot rents, right? Yeah. But because our units are so differentiated, I really had to, like, per square foot didn't work, right? So I'll give you an example. So if I took our, you know, 1,750 square feet of net leasable space and I did it by $3 a foot, you know, I can't do the math right now, but our rents would be huge. And I started thinking about it. I go, if I'm a renter and I want to rent this type of a unit, what's my choice in the marketplace? So I think of, you know, from a developer standpoint, who's my competition when I go to, you know, put this unit out in the marketplace. And in the beginning, it actually, we really defaulted to houses that rented, like single family houses in a neighborhood, right? And so really where we started to work this whole dollar rent scenario is we're such a different product. We didn't worry about competing with apartments in the normal mainstream, right? You know, you're just not going to find really, you know, hardly any, right? Almost none. So I go, okay, we need to assess our rent levels based on competition from houses. So normally what we would do, and we're refined a little bit since then, is we, you know, if the lowest price comparable house in a neighborhood rented for $4,000, then we go, oh, we want to be at, you know, $3,000, $3,250, $3,500. I want somebody to look at this unit and this rent and go, gosh, that's a great value, or at least it's a value, right? It's better value than the house. I've always told our leasing teams, like, if a family had their choice, they'd always rent the house, you know, American dream, white picket fence, backyard. I think any family would rent, you know, as a choice if things were equal rents. So we had to give logic to value for the tenant to go, this makes sense. Now, what we found in the meantime is that most renters of apartments don't think of themselves as renters of houses, which is interesting to me, right? They, in fact, what's starting to show up is people are like, gosh, I didn't even know there were 5-bedroom apartments. I've never heard of that. But you're on, you know, rental site A, or you're on Zillow or apartments.com. And so all of a sudden we give them a new space of possibility of how, where to live. They go, oh, I could have my whole family, and you have a ground floor bedroom bathroom for grandma to live in, and you've got
a garage. Yeah, you mean I don't have to pay $6,000 a month for assisted living?
Right. And they go, and it's, you know, $3,500. In fact, one of the ways that we look at it, which is, I think, sort of maybe more common in student housing, is we'll actually do the math of rent per bedroom, right?
Oh, interesting.
Because when tenants come in, families come in, they're looking at the whole dollar rent, but because they share between the family groups, all the income earners, they go, oh, you know, this is, you know, 800 per bedroom or whatever the rent would be for a particular unit. And they really, you know, it's just like, you know, anybody who has a car payment or a mortgage payment, they're not worried about the per square foot. They're thinking about the logic of my paycheck, who's in the house earning income. And if I spread that amongst everybody, what's that for each person? And that literally, when we tour around with the tenants in the leasing, you know, meetings or the, you know, the tours, you can watch them do the math. They'll even talk about it. Yeah. Oh, if I did this, you know, 3,500 by five. Okay. You know, okay. Yeah. And they, you know, the light bulb goes on. And mind you, this doesn't even account for all the, you know, we have, you know, air conditioning, right? 2-car garage in, you know, in unit laundry room, you know, we got a master suite. It's brand new. We got quartz countertops. You know, we got, you know, nice production cabinets with self-closing. You know, we got, you know, recessed lights. For all intents and purposes, guys, for most families who look at our units and are moving out of older product, they've never had an apartment like this to rent. Like, because
it doesn't sound like an apartment. It just doesn't fit into that box, that matrix in your head of it does not compute.
I even call it, and that's exactly right. In fact, I say, you know, purposely designed and built to rent, but lives like a house.
Yeah. Sure. And you know, I've got several friends who are value add multifamily developers, you know, and they seems like the strategy now is they really want to make it amenity rich. So they're doing all these different things, turning tennis courts into soccer fields and doing barbecue areas or a dog park and a Wi-Fi community center. Do you guys have like a community event center, or is that not necessarily part of the rollout?
It's not a specific objective of ours to always have amenities or common area space. Now, I don't want people to get the wrong impression. We're not indifferent to the need for it.
Yeah.
But a couple things that happen is, one is the tenants who rent in our units are really not oriented around that. They're looking for the price and the ability to fit their family in the unit. That is like, you know, 80 to 90% of the decision, you know, like, you know, weighting of their decision is 80 or 90% of that. We always try to produce common area when we can. Now, the first several projects that we built were infill, and they're really all infill, very tight sites, limited capacity to do common areas. Now, that's the, you know, so the early phase. As we get into bigger projects, so like right now we're working on an 85 unit project in El Monte, which is San Gabriel Valley.
And the 85 would be on the larger end of that spectrum?
Yeah, correct. And okay. So that actually, in that case, that project, we're going to donate an acre of parkland out of the 5 acres that we're purchasing and give it to the city to develop as a park. Cool. And then our project will, you know, sort of surround it on two sides, and we're going to have pedestrian gates from our project, from our community into the park.
Cool.
Right. So that kids can go into, I mean, it is a public park, so it'll be open to the public. So it's not exclusive to us, but we're going to integrate our design and accessibility from the site into the park. It also happens to be located to a transit station, and then beautifully enough, right next to a shopping, like a market. In fact, we're going to try to negotiate a gate from our property onto the, you know, to the retail, grocery anchored, retail center next door. So as we get bigger, the point I'm making is that we'll always try to accommodate, you know, and we'll have some other common space besides the park in this El Monte project. So that's the first example that we're really having the opportunity to truly design it. And functionally, you know, in my head, 100 units of UTH is sort of, there's no hard limit. But think about it, we're creating a lot of density in bedrooms. We're not doing density in units, we're doing density in bedrooms, but that's still people occupying. You know, we don't have, you know, some cities go, oh, you know, you're going to have like, five bedrooms, gosh, you know, you're going to have three people in each bedroom, 15, 20 people. We don't. I mean, in fact, one of the interesting things sort of during the coronavirus era is we've actually seen a shrinking in our pool of people who come see the units for tours, because they're looking for this working from home scenario and more space in the context of, you know, of work from home and, you know, being sequestered right from coronavirus. So people are like, hey, that downstairs bedroom, I'm not, you know, grandma's not going there. That's I'm working. Or one family was two college students and a mom, and that was going to be their study room. And these are just anecdotal examples. But I think it's a real key that there's a big move towards bigger houses, at least in the near term. I don't think that'll, you know, survive the long term, because we're going to go back to the mean of economic capacity for families to afford housing, at least in California, all major urban metros. So we'll return to that, hey, I'm trying to get the most house for the wages that we make and can afford, right, within, you know, sort of a reasonable standard.
Yep. Great. Well, man, I've got so many more questions here, but I know that we want to wrap this up. And I've got one question kind of off topic, you know, before we let you go, you know, outside of money, you know, what motivates you to do what you're doing? I mean, what's your why, and what are you doing outside of the office that drives you?
Well, first is, you know, to take care of my family. And I think you guys will say, you know, absolutely. And, you know, that's what I work to, you know, build this company and grow it and produce profitable projects. But I'm very enthusiastic about the social impact component of this, guys. I mean, while this is not affordable housing in the standard sense, if you think about these families, they're working class families, they're salt of the earth. Blue collar, you might describe it. And for all intents and purposes, the development marketplace has completely ignored them. In fact, you'll hear people say, as you listen for it, they go, oh, there's no way to make that work. I was on Marcus and Millichap or some webinar a couple of days ago. And, you know, guy from one of the larger apartment, you know, development shops, REITs, he goes, oh, you know, the middle income housing, the workforce housing, it just doesn't work. I go, well, I disagree, but fine. Okay. But, you know, the service of, you know, our developments in light of taking care of these families is such a huge, you know, just, it's not an ancillary benefit. That would be the wrong way to say it. It really is one of the main components of it. I mean, we're super enthusiastic to be taking care of these families, because really, for, as I said, nobody's thinking about them. Yeah. And in California, particularly, I mean, we're losing our middle class at a huge clip, right? I mean, they're moving to you guys in Albuquerque, they're moving to Texas, you're moving to Phoenix, you're moving to Denver, they're getting the heck out of California. I don't blame them, right? I mean, if you can move to Dallas and keep relatively same income that you produce in California, and your housing costs are cut in half and your overall lifestyle, you should move. Like, that's a good move. But there are people who want to stay in California, right? Their extended families here, their kids are in school, they don't want to disrupt. Maybe they have a good job. They're from here, they're natives, right? And so there's a lot of people who still have the logic that staying here is the right move for them. And then we go, okay, so, you know, heretofore those people have been ignored generally, at least trying to serve them directly in light of the family lifestyle that they want to live, and particularly multi-generationally. We're like super happy to be, you know, delivering this, you know, this social impact besides, you know, just producing viable projects.
That's reassuring to hear, because so many people associate developers with coming in and moving out, you know, lower income families and gentrification and where are we supposed to go and that whole argument. So
it's, and it does happen. I mean, you know, I'm the first to acknowledge, and you know, you guys are in the business I am. I mean, the real estate development community generally does not have the greatest reputation. Yeah. And so it's guys like us, you know, on this, discussion conversation today, they go, hey, look, we can be oriented. I mean, we got to produce profitable projects. Let's not, like, you know, we're not pretending And, you know, even in affordable housing, it still has to produce, you know, income to developers for them to do it. Otherwise, there'd be motivation to do it.
Right.
But this is sort of the, you know, some people call it the double bottom line, right? Doing well by doing good. You know, we're very much oriented, you know, profitability, viability does come first, because without that, we can't serve the families. But that, you know, family development orientation is super close second. In fact, we do things, you know, we're setting up a program to provide free Wi-Fi on all of our sites. And then for any families that you know, don't have computers, you know, we're buying Chromebooks and,
awesome.
You know, basically just giving them to the family. Because I go, if a family moves into our community and they can't afford, they don't have internet and they don't have a computer, that's a huge disadvantage. And like for us, like, you know, we're just doing, you know, free Wi-Fi because it's a cool thing and, you know, what a needed tool. But then I go, oh, but if they don't have computers, they can't use it. So, you know, two or three Chromebooks per family is, you know, that's an easy decision for us to make. So that's actually something that we're doing.
Even here in Albuquerque, they said that 50% of the students throughout New Mexico don't have access to Wi-Fi, and we're doing online schooling right now. So
it's crazy, right? I mean, and we were already sort of thinking about it. And then again, not to pat ourselves on the back, I think this is just, this digital divide's been an issue for, you know, since computers became like a you know, major competitive, like the major competitive, you know, tool to have internet and a computer.
Yeah.
But, you know, virtual, you know, life and schooling and coronavirus just accelerated that. I mean, it went from, okay, we can deal with it because kids can go to school and use the facilities there and get some computer time, to like, you're locked out.
Yeah.
If you're a kid who doesn't have internet and a computer, you're like done.
You're falling behind.
I mean, it's, in fact, people were saying, oh, you know, statistically, you know, sort of assessing a, you know, half a year to a year loss in educational, you know, advancement, which would show up for people in their career later, of some diminution in their career earnings just from a loss of a year in school. And I was like, man, that's crazy. Right. So, you know, we're like, you know, I'm super, you know, jazzed about this Chromebook and internet thing. It really feels good. Now, what we are finding is a lot of people already have computers. We go, great, use the free Wi-Fi. I mean, you can't game on it. It's like, not got enough good speed for that. For those kids who are going to want to do it.
Well,
hey, Ray, you have any other questions before we wrap up?
I have one last one too, and you just kind of tapped on it a little bit. So there's the social success side of it. What's the most profitable part of workforce housing? If you had a magic sauce, if you will.
I think, I think if I'm understanding your answer, your question is it's the undersupply story there.
Okay.
Right. And you know, that undersupply doesn't make it more profitable, right? I think, to answer your question, like literally, but if you look at it, you go, what I'm always measuring is confidence levels and likelihood of success, mitigating risk to increase likelihood of success. Part of that is to be competing in markets that are not oversupplied. I mean, this is the standard development story. I mean, as you guys know, in retail, I mean, you guys, you know, look at the retail environment, you know, oversupply of retail has been a story, a narrative for, you know, for years now. And in the residential sector, overbuilding of a particular product type in a particular geography, that's the standard story, right? And so we really look at it and we go, it's undersupply, but it's really undersupply for a very long time, right? Like, we're not going to catch up the demand, supply to demand in, you know, working class families anytime soon. Now, eventually, as enough people like myself get, you know, on board to doing this product type, it will catch up. But I look at it this way. I mean, in California, and for political reasons, like resistance to housing, I mean, we're probably several decades out from catching up at, you know, all levels of housing production. I mean, we've been underproducing housing by probably, I don't know, a factor of four or five for decades. And so I look at it. In fact, there's a study that the, it's the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies did a study of Southern California, and they came up with a metric of 1 million unit shortfall just in the counties that make up SoCal, right?
And there's only so many, Scott, chopping.
Right. I look at that. I go, look, we could build this for the rest of my career. And, you know, hopefully I have three kids and, you know, hopefully my kids might go into the business as well and for their career. And so, and it's not to be cute and, but you know, if you're going to look and assess a marketplace and start to, you know, refine the things about the characteristics of a market that increase your success, your likelihood of success, then I go, that's what makes it profitable. In fact, I'll share this with you. My saying is that complexity is the enemy of profits in the real estate development business. That the more complex project that you take on, the more complex market that you take on, the more complex construction methodologies, entitlement, complexity, and land acquisition, all those add friction to the process, which both slows down your development cycle, but also increases the likelihood for mistakes to show up or breakdowns to be caused. And you can never eliminate all the friction. You can't reduce, you know, like I use the term simplify, but not simple, right? Development will never be simple in the way that, you know, we know. But I go, what's going to increase the likelihood of success? You maybe call it risk mitigation, right? To put a more institutional, you know, distinction to it. But, you know, I just look what helps us increase the success of execution. Bottom line, right? If something hurts that, slows it down. If buying sites that need zoning slows us down, then let's not do that. Even though we're really good at it, you know, we come from California. It's almost like, you know, requirement to be good at that. But I'm at my arc of my career, guys, I'm happy to be doing things that reduce complexity. And I've done, like, I have never done a high-rise project. We build a lot of mid-rise podium product. That was the most brutal learning, mistake, pain process I ever went through. And so we go, we know how to do that. We're good at it now. And we go, let's not do that.
We see that gray hair and you earned it, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out.
Right here.
It's coming for you guys soon. No,
well, man, it's been great having you on. This has just been fantastic. Learned a lot. I mean, it's refreshing to hear an asset class that's just seeing so much, you know, success and growth. And again, that social.
I'm going to start sending you some sites out here in Albuquerque and saying, hey, man, you want to put this under contract for us?
Yeah, happy to be of help. I mean, it's just my, you know, that's my philosophy generally, just to be an offer of help. But certainly, you know, and that is true for anybody who's listening today. You know, feel free to reach out to me and, you know, be happy to engage.
And what is the best way, Scott, for our listeners that may want to get in touch with you? We'll have it in the show notes, but while we have you here, what's the best way?
Yeah, so they can go to our website, which is www.urbanpacific.com, and go to the contact page, and our entire team's emails are there. My cell phone number is there. People are welcome to text me. Don't call me, text me. I don't answer my phone anymore. And then I would encourage people when they're on the site, go to our investor education section, and we got a ton of content on there, articles, videos, podcasts, all related around sort of what we've talked about today, which is, you know, educating investors, you know, about the multifamily development marketplace. Obviously, we talk about workforce housing, but there's a bunch in there about market trends, market cycles, you know, the economic tracking, cycle tracking tools that we use. And then I would just finish with this. There's a red sign up button on every page on the website. Get on our Saturday email list and you'll get this stuff just, you know, coming into your inbox every Saturday morning. And we're really very disciplined and rigorous about, you know, making it valuable content. I mean, every once in a while we'll talk about stuff we're doing, but, you know, we're looking to, you know, the thinking you heard today in this interview, you know, about the research you guys described, which I appreciate, you know, the kudos on that. We're just sharing that out in the marketplace. Hey, here's a new trend. Hey, here's a, you know, ULI did this study, check it out. You know, we're just serving that stuff up regularly.
Yeah, we saw that you were on Dr. Adam Gower's podcast too, and this is like right in his wheelhouse.
Just
all this content out there. It's great.
Yeah, love Adam. In fact, we collaborate with Adam regularly, and he also teaches at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which is my alma mater. So we have that in common.
Small world.
And you know, he's lucky to live in San Luis Obispo, which is this cool little college town on the central coast of California. So we're a little jealous.
Very cool. Well, we will let you run, man. Thank you so much for your time.
Clayton Gannon, thank you so much, man. Great to be here with you guys.
Hey, listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. If you feel someone within your network would benefit and learn from this podcast, please feel free to share this or any other episode with them. If you feel you have benefited from this podcast, please leave us a review on any platform where you listen to podcasts. We greatly appreciate your support and feedback, and we look forward to connecting with you on the next show. Until then, stay healthy, stay safe, stay educated.